12. The Injustice to Sandy Koufax. Mom up on a stepladder. That image endures in our heads for a lot of reasons beyond the holidays. Our parents were do-it-yourself people. We never had a cleaning woman or a handyman. If something needed doing, Mom and Dad did it, including house painting. We always had cans of paint in the garage ready to go should Dad feel like taking on a home improvement project. But these served a purpose beyond sprucing up 346 Cordova Street. See, Mom had a superstition. Sometimes Dad struggled to get acting work. Unlike Ron and me, who were working constantly, he had cold spells where he simply couldn't land a part. We'd hear him mouth off to Mom about that son-of-a-bitch actor who beat him out for a role in The Big Valley, or a casting director who was going on my list, Gene, for not putting him in Mannix. If the cold spell was short, a matter of a few weeks, Dad bided his time writing scripts, and that's when we'd see Hulk Hal come over to hang with him and bat ideas back and forth. But when things got ice cold, and Dad went months without an acting job, Mom did the most ingenious thing. She broke out the paint cans. Mom recognized that idleness was Dad's enemy, and she never wanted him to drift through a day without purpose. So she would get out the paint and the brushes and tell him, "The service porch needs painting, Rance." That sprung him out of his funk. These painting jobs were never a ruse. The service porch really did need a new coat, but they were also the product of superstition. Mom genuinely believed that if she pulled out the paint cans, an acting job would come Dad's way, leaving her holding the brushes. The amazing thing was that this trick worked. The clanking sound of those cans coming out was almost always followed by the sound of the phone ringing, Dad's agent telling him that he was wanted for the Monroes or the Virginians. The next thing you know, Dad would be off working on the Universal back lot, and when Ron and I got home from school, it was Mom we found doing the painting, up on the stepladder with a mentholated Kool in her mouth. It was a sight that never failed to crack us up. These house painting jobs didn't do Mom's lungs any favors. Between her nonstop smoking and the fumes she was inhaling from the thick, oil-based paints that they used. But there was a sweetness to how this scenario played out over and over again. Mom loved the power of positive thinking messaging of her superstition. If she took out the paint cans, Dad would get a part. It was only a matter of when. I'm sure that Ron and I glimpsed only a fraction of the psychological support that Mom gave Dad to keep him going in our tough, unforgiving business. But I'm glad we have this memory of her on the stepladder. As hilarious as we found it then, it was a picture of love.
As Clint mentioned, the gentle bin period was a good one for Dad professionally. He wrote and acted on Clint's show, and right before he began work on it, he landed a recurring role on an ABC program called The Monroes, which starred a young Barbara Hershey. That show was sort of a Western precursor to Party of Five, about five frontier kids who are left orphaned in the Grand Tetons and forced to make their own way. Since the younger kids were child actors, and since Dad had a proven track record with us, ABC hired Dad to serve also as the Monroes' dialogue coach. It was also a time when Dad and Mom were pulling in about $12,000 a year as our managers, in addition to what Dad was earning from his acting and writing. These weren't earth-shattering sums of money, and my parents were extremely cautious investors, but they were disciplined about budgeting and saving. So, in 1968, after 5 years on Cordova Street, we moved to a larger house. We didn't move far, all of a mile and a half, to the town immediately west of Burbank, Toluca Lake. But physically and symbolically, it was a big step up. Toluca Lake carried an air of prestige. It was where Andy Griffith lived, as well as Bob Hope and Frankie Avalon. Our new house on Clybourne Avenue had 4 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, and a 2-car garage. It was surrounded by leafy, mature trees. It even had a guest house in the back, which Dad commandeered as his office. The house had a brick facade, and its handsome shingled roof had 3 dormers. Each the front window of a bedroom. Mine was the one on the right, Clint's was the one on the left, and the middle bedroom became Mom's sewing room. She and Dad had the master bedroom downstairs. By today's standards of L.A. showbiz living, our house would be considered modest. But Clint and I couldn't believe our good fortune. We had room to roam. And on Sundays, in a huge victory for our autonomy, we were allowed to walk by ourselves to Patty's Restaurant, a diner that we loved and a Toluca Lake mainstay still in operation today. Clint and I enjoyed sitting at the counter and watching the short order cook in action while we ate breakfast, just the two of us. For Dad and Mom, the house on Clybourne represented the summit of their material aspirations. It was their kingdom and castle. Though they both lived into the 21st century, they never moved again. And they so loved the house that for the first and only time, they took out a mortgage for $62,000. It took them only a few years to pay it off in full. "We own it, free and clear," Mom told us with pride. Toluca Lake was a little ritzier than Burbank, but our way of life remained fundamentally unchanged. Dad kept driving his Chevy Nova Supersport all the way through the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, by which time it was a certifiable road hazard. Mom drove a series of Buicks and Oldsmobiles. We never had an imported car or anything that could be described as a luxury vehicle. It's a sign of our parents' integrity that this was their version of moving on up. As possibly the most ethical talent managers in the history of show business, they were significantly underbilling their clients, Clint and me. Managers usually collect up to 15% of their clients' earnings, but Dad felt that most of what he and Mom did fell under the rubric of parental responsibility rather than professional management. They found the idea of taking anything more than 5% to be immoral, though Clint and I would not have objected in the least. Mom and Dad were concerned about the damage it might do us boys if we were taught to think of ourselves as the family breadwinners. And they simply didn't hunger for a flashy life or a Beverly Hills address. They were sophisticated hicks. They had all that they wanted. Because Dad adhered to a policy of transparency about money, I was aware pretty much from the outset of The Andy Griffith Show of how much I was making. I was also alerted by Dad to the offers that came my way outside of the show. Pretty early on, for example, a manufacturer approached my agent about launching an Opie Taylor line of children's clothing, for which I would serve as ambassador and spokesmodel. The agent really pushed hard on the offer, telling Dad that it would be lucrative. But Dad told me that he turned it down because it would have entailed frequent travel and in-store personal appearances that would have cut into my time being a kid. "You need to play," he said. "Promoting clothes is not acting. You're not going to learn anything by doing that. You might be upset with us later that we turned this down, but your mom and I don't think it's worth considering." I've never once regretted their decision, and I appreciate that they let me know about the opportunity in the moment, rather than have me learn about it years later. It never really kicked in that I was earning serious money until one day in 1966, when I was doing my usual routine of reading the sports pages of the Los Angeles Times first thing in the morning. The paper contained troubling news. Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale, the future Hall of Fame pitchers who anchored the rotation of my beloved Dodgers, were holding out of training camp for more money. This was in the days before free agency, when players had little leverage or negotiating power. Koufax and Drysdale, the Times reported, were making $85,000 and $80,000 a season, respectively, and wanted to be paid about twice that amount. This seemed fair to me. The previous season, Koufax had gone 26-8 with a 2.04 ERA, pitched a perfect game, and swept the Cy Young and World Series MVP awards for the second time in 3 years. Drysdale was right behind Koufax, having gone 23-12. I thought, this makes me wonder, what do I get paid relative to these guys? Sitting down with a pencil and a piece of paper, I did some calculations. We had just completed shooting the sixth season of The Andy Griffith Show. I knew that I was earning $1,850 an episode. That season, we shot 30 episodes. Okay, that tallied up to $55,500. Plus, I was already earning residuals from summer and daytime reruns of The Andy Griffith Show, in addition to residuals for other things I'd been in. When I added all these sums together, I discovered that I was, what? Out-earning Sandy and Big D. My first reaction was mortification. It just felt unfair, flat out wrong, that these grown men, who were the best in the world at what they did, were making less money than me, a kid actor. I cycled through emotions of embarrassment, confusion, and anger. But what I finally landed upon was gratitude. I had to acknowledge that I had been blessed with good fortune and a wealth of advantages. This marked a moment of maturation for me. First, I learned a harsh lesson. The world isn't always fair. Next, I felt a new sense of responsibility. How do I live up to this good fortune and not squander it? Now think about it. I was a 12-year-old boy. I could have reacted entirely differently. I might have figured out that I was earning six figures and thought, hell yeah, I'm rich, baby. Suck it, Sandy. I could have undergone a personality transformation and started strutting around school like a James Spader villain in a 1980s teen movie. But I didn't, because I looked to my parents. I saw how they chose to live and how happy they were. And I redoubled my efforts to keep on working, to stay in show business beyond my boyhood. Not just because the money was good, but because I recognized how much I truly loved acting and learning about directing. As for Koufax and Drysdale, their holdout ended after a few weeks when they got raises to respectively $125,000 and $110,000 a season. It was less than what they'd been asking for, but still, I was relieved. Justice had been served. By the time I was 14 in 1968, I was desperate to chart my own fate, to be in charge of something. I was by then a huge Los Angeles Lakers fan, and my fame as Opie had provided me with an opportunity to meet my favorite player, Elgin Baylor, at an Easter Seals fundraising event. We stood together for no more than 30 seconds as a photographer took our picture outside of the Lakers' locker room at the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena. But simply standing next to the man known as Rabbit, me pointing upward to the basket while Elgin pretended he was about to shoot, had a huge impact on me. I knew that I had no hope of ever playing basketball on his level, but I was crazy about the game, and it became my best sport. As a player, I was an undersized but dogged, pesky little shooting guard. Well, to be honest, I was terrible when I started out in sixth grade. My friend, Noel Salvatore, was legitimately good at basketball, though, and when we discovered that we had missed the cutoff date to sign up for the Burbank Parks and Recreation Center's Bantam League, Noel audaciously proposed that we take the unusual step of putting together our own team. We went door to door to local businesses, cold calling them, until we found a sponsor, a local bank called Surety Savings and Loan. Then the league found a grown-up who was willing to be our coach. Once again, I was subjected to ridicule. The very first time I caught a pass, I nervously dribbled the ball out of bounds. I didn't understand the court layout. Can you imagine Opie making such an ass of himself, losing track of court boundaries, and then taking too many steps to the basket and getting called for traveling? It was hideous. But I practiced and practiced until I got pretty good. And by the time I was in eighth grade and jonesing to be a leader, I hit upon the idea of being Clint's coach. What if I put together a squad composed of Clint and his third grade buddies and molded them in my image? This time I went straight to Dad. Could he be the sponsor and nominal coach of a Bantam League team? He wrote a check, and thus Howard's Hurricanes were born. Dad was the figurehead and disciplinarian, but he left the actual coaching to me. We had Howard's Hurricanes uniforms made up with green t-shirts and yellow shorts. There was nothing subliminal about why I was so driven to do this. It was to prepare myself to become a film director. I actually said the words aloud. If I could learn how to handle a bunch of unruly 8-year-olds, I could one day probably figure out how to cope with a temperamental actor. I won't name any names, but I have since discovered that, behaviorally, there are times when Category 1 and Category 2 are almost exactly the same thing. In the Bantam League, the hoops were lowered from 10 feet to 8 to give the kids a better chance of scoring. I ran practices once or twice a week, and we played the games on Saturday. Clint was a good player, and he had a couple of friends who were natural athletes, authentically skilled. But the others ranged from average to downright uncoordinated. What I'm proudest of about my tenure as the Howard's Hurricanes coach is that I molded our strategies to the kids' abilities. At John Burroughs High School, where I was playing round ball, I was nagged by the feeling that my coach was too systematic and inflexible, running patterns and setting defenses that stifled our players' individual talents. I didn't want to duplicate his approach. The Hurricanes were, for the most part, an undersized team. I thought that we stood a better chance if we played a wide-open run-and-gun style, allowing our players more freedom to shoot from the outside and cover their opponents one-on-one. I set out to maximize the abilities that each kid brought naturally to the court. We had one kid who was gangly and couldn't shoot to save his life, so I made him our defensive enforcer and rebounder. Another kid was tiny but proficient at dribbling, so when we were trying to run out the clock, I told him, "We're going to pass it to you and let you do your thing." Over time, through repeated practice and regular playing time, these kids would transcend their limited roles and become more well-rounded players. That was another thing. At Dad's insistence, every boy had to play at least half the game. So I couldn't just ride my best players and keep the less skilled on the bench. Despite these limitations, the Hurricanes were a consistently decent team for our first 2 seasons, and we won the league championship in our 3rd season. I flat out loved being a coach. One time we played a team that outclassed us by far in talent, coached by Bill Burton, the father of the future director Tim Burton, who was Clint's age. Mr. Burton was a former professional baseball player who served as one of the administrators of the Burbank Parks and Rec Department. He had a buzz cut and looked like a Marine. We were all kind of scared of him. Despite his militaristic appearance, Mr. Burton had boys on his team with hair down to their shoulders, including his son Tim, who, improbable as it may sound, had some deft moves on the court. I knew there was a chance that we could get slaughtered. But not too long before this game, the basketball coach at USC, Bob Boyd, had made national headlines by nearly beating John Wooden's powerhouse UCLA team featuring the all-world center Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, then known as Lou Alcindor, by slowing down the game to a crawl, a strategy known as stall ball. Like the NCAA, the Burbank Bantam League did not have a shot clock, so I ordered the Hurricanes into a stall against Mr. Burton's team. By the end of the first half, the score was 4-2 in favor of the Burtons. My strategy was working. We were behind, but just barely, well within range of taking the lead. But the parents in the stands were furious at me. Some of them shouted, "Ronnie, let them play." Others yelled less polite things. Dad let me stick to my guns until the 4th quarter, when I did indeed let the kids run and shoot. We lost 12-6, a respectable margin, but I still believe we could have stall-balled our way to victory. I coached the Howard's Hurricanes all the way until I turned 20, moving up through the age brackets with Clint and his friends. By the time they were in 7th grade, they had graduated from the Bantam League to the Junior High League, playing with hoops mounted at the regulation 10 feet. I occasionally got temperamental. There was a game where we were behind, and the ref was a guy my age who I knew from playing baseball. I felt that too many calls were going against the Hurricanes. "You're killing me, Ed!" I shouted at the guy, pacing the sidelines like a madman. "You're blowing it over and over again." Ed, very sensibly, told me to sit down. "Yeah," I said, going full Bobby Knight. "Give me a T." "Fine, T," Ed said. Give me another tea, I shouted. Tea, said Ed. My face nearly as red as my hair, I screamed, I'm gone, and stomped off. Dad had to follow me out and place a hand on each shoulder to calm me down. The best I can explain this uncharacteristic outburst is that I had seen a coach go ballistic on TV, and the actor in me overtook the coach. I never let this happen again. It's extraordinary how well my stint coaching these kids prepared me for my directing career. I have found that I work best and achieve the most by tailoring a plan to the strengths of the people with whom I'm collaborating, rather than rigidly adhering to some preconceived Ron Howard method. There is no such method. In fact, that's one of the reasons that I don't have what you'd call an authorial signature, and why my films have been so varied in tone and subject matter. Coaching also taught me one of the most important attributes for a filmmaker, patience. I saw kids struggle through half the season before suddenly emerging as quality players once everything clicked for them. I saw my strategies fail in multiple games before they succeeded. It's the same when I develop and direct a film. The first few drafts of a screenplay can seem hopeless until the writer suddenly turns a corner. A challenging scene bedevils the actors and me alike until we hit upon a solution. Intuitively, I still apply the lessons in leadership I learned 50 years ago to the movies and TV shows I make now.
Ron could easily have become a head basketball coach at the high school or college level. It wasn't just that he was good at teaching the dorkier guys specific skills, like how to box out your opponent when you're going for the rebound. It was how he encouraged his players and celebrated their successes. When our second-string center grabbed a rebound in a live game, Coach Ron was the first to slap the kid's hand as he ran up the court on offense, saying, "Now that's how you do it!" Ron and I benefited in another way from our Howard's Hurricanes exploits, besides enjoying the competition and the teamwork. We established ourselves in the community as citizens rather than as child actor curiosities. We never heard Dopey Opie or Where's Your Bear on the court during Hurricanes games or in the three-on-three pickup games we played at the rec center. Our teammates and opponents knew that we had this odd other life, but it didn't matter to them. For Ron and me, this was meaningful. It furthered the idea that we had identities independent of who we were on sound stages and the back lots. The correlation between coaching and directing turned literal when Ron asked me to recruit some of my buddies to join me in the cast of Ron's earliest attempts at directing. The first short we did was called The Ball Game. It was simply a dramatization of a wiffle ball game. The film begins with me waking up in the morning in my underwear, getting dressed, and calling up my friends on the telephone to invite them over to our place. The Clybourne Avenue house had a great setup for wiffle ball. Its previous residents were a Chinese-American family whose kids were a singing group, sort of a Chinese-language Osmonds, who performed at fairs and festivals. The parents had torn up part of the backyard and replaced the grass with paved concrete, creating an outdoor rehearsal space. For Ron and me, this became our sports arena. Dad put up two basketball backboards, and we configured the space for wiffle ball, putting down bases and defining outfield boundaries that were vaguely modeled on Boston's Fenway Park.
The ball game ended up running about 20 minutes. It was hideously boring, no sound, and I included every pitch of every inning. But it was a great exercise in experimentation, way more creative than the rudimentary home movies that I'd shot using the Bell & Howell 8mm camera that the Andy Griffith guys had given me years earlier. My most artful effort on that camera was a short in which I had Dad playing a hobo trying to break into the house. He peered through the window for one shot and climbed on the roof for another. It was shot in order so that I wouldn't have to edit it. By the mid-1960s, standard 8mm was replaced by a new format called Super 8. Dad bought a Kodak Brownie Super 8 camera for his own use. I borrowed it to make The Ball Game. I planned my shots, tried different angles, and pointed out to Clint's buddies where their marks were. Then I edited the picture myself. With my own money, I purchased a primitive Super 8 home editing system that consisted of two cranks, a view screen, and a splicer. To edit a scene, I had to hand crank the film back and forth, manually cut it on the splicer, sometimes nicking a finger in the process, and then bind together my edited scenes with adhesive tape lined up with sprocket holes, more or less in the same way that you would apply a Band-Aid to a cut. Editing this way was incredibly time-consuming, but it became my favorite part of the filmmaking process. The intensive labor soothed me in a zen way. I never cared much for erector sets or model airplanes, but I could edit for hours on end. That said, for the ball game, I clearly didn't edit aggressively enough. Still, I was pleased. I considered it my debut as a filmmaker. 20 years later, my memories of that film inspired the Little League scenes in my movie Parenthood. My next film was the product of my resistance to doing household chores. Dad asked me to mow the lawn one Saturday. Rather than flat out refuse, I pitched him an idea. "Dad, I have this idea for a short film. It's about a military veteran, a man about your age. Not an Air Force guy like you, a guy who was in the Army." This detail came to me because we owned a combat helmet that Dad had bought for us at an Army surplus store. I used it when I played World War II with the Cordova Street Boys. "This vet doesn't just mow the lawn," I said. "He puts on his helmet, he salutes, and he attacks the grass with his manual mower like it's the enemy. It'll be a satirical film, Dad. I'll use lots of ground-level shots of the mower coming right at the camera with grass flying all over the place." Dad smiled. "That sounds like a strong, low-angle shot. Could be pretty good," he said. And so we set to work on my next film. Dad was no easy mark. He knew damn well that I was finagling my way out of a chore. But he admired my initiative in wanting to make movies, and he enjoyed hamming it up in the Army helmet, taking direction from his son. I kept coming up with different camera angles until the lawn was completely mowed. We watched the finished product together as a family using our two-speed Bell & Howell projector and one of those stand-up screens that 1960s families had where you hoisted up the screen from a tripod base. Dad was delighted at the finished product. I was delighted that he was delighted.
Life was good, and it was about to get better. Not long after we moved to Toluca Lake, Mom surprised Ron and me with the news that she was expecting. I was over the moon. I wanted to experience what Ron had experienced, being an older brother. I imagined the baby in my mother's womb as a boy, because that was all I knew. But I would have been equally happy with a sister. I was eager to have my own protege, an acolyte. Ron was as happy as I was, but we noticed that Dad, normally full of energy and good cheer, seemed down. He talked about our pending siblings in sighs and shrugs, not with any negativity, but definitely with a sense of resignation. One day, when Dad was out, we brought this observation to Mom. Her explanation to us was as shocking as it was masterfully and gently delivered. "Dad," she said, "was happy that we boys were getting older and more independent, requiring less oversight and handholding. Because of this, he was looking forward to spending more time pursuing his own passions." But this new baby was a surprise, unplanned, and raising him or her would turn back the parental responsibility clock to zero. Hard news for Dad to swallow. "He loves having children, and he loves you boys," Mom told us, but he thought it was time to get started on his career again.
Clint and I had not really understood until that point how much Dad had intentionally deprioritized his aspirations to do important work as an actor and writer. This was the first time that I recognized that he had paid a toll of sorts for our success and our rich education in the business. Rance Howard was only 40 years old, with the better part of his adulthood ahead of him. But 40 is a tough age if you're still trying to break through as a leading man. For how much longer would he have to wait for his own moment in the sun? Dad's worries turned out to be moot. Sadly, we never got to meet the new little Howard. Mom suffered a miscarriage a few weeks after they broke the news to us of her pregnancy. Dad rose to this moment. He was loving and gracious toward Mom, comforting her in his arms. Very little was said to Clint and me about the matter then and ever afterward. But I could tell without any words being spoken that Dad was relieved.